We are talking once again with Maria Tomchik, local writer and activist, here to give us a wrap-up of this past week's news. Good afternoon.
Good afternoon.
All right. No Jav again this week, but I just saw last night he is back from the hospital at home.
He's resting.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, after being 10 or 11 days in the hospital. So good news there. So hopefully he'll be back next week. But
yes.
All right. So in the meantime, plenty happened while he was in the hospital.
Yeah.
Like an election.
Yes, and I just want to go over some of the final results here in the local election first, and then we'll talk about the national election a little bit later. First off, in the very close race in District 3 here in Washington State, Democrat Marie Glusenkamp-Perez was declared the winner against the Trump-backed Joe Kent by a little under 3,000 votes. It's close enough that Joe Kent has been pushing to get ballots that were tossed out counted. So it sounds like he's trying to challenge, but I don't think it's quite close enough that he'll be able to get it overturned. So this district, District 3, has flipped from Republican to Democrat this year. And interestingly, without any financial help from the National Democratic Campaign Committee, even though it was a very close race and it was looking really good for Glusenkamp-Perez going into the race, the National Democratic Party didn't think it was worth backing her.
Which is mind-blowing.
Yeah, absolutely mind-blowing. It's really the best example I can think of how the National Democratic Party apparatus really needs to change its approach and start supporting new, younger, progressive candidates like Perez.
Because it's not like they don't have the funding to do that.
Oh, absolutely. And of course, incumbent Democrat Kim Schreier in District 8 beat Matt Larkin by more than 22,000 votes. And that was terrific news, not nearly as close as the polls were making it sound like it would be. So this means that Washington State will be sending 8 Democrats and 2 Republicans to the House this year. Now, for candidates within the state of Washington, for the Washington State Legislature and the state government, the fairly close race for Secretary of State, incumbent Democrat Steve Hobbs, held off a challenge by the nonpartisan Julie Anderson by over 100,000 votes. So again, not as close as polls made it seem. He ran on a platform of protecting election security, expanding voter access, and combating misinformation. And it appears that voters really care about those issues more than the nonpartisan message that Anderson embraced.
It helped that he was the incumbent, even though he'd only been in that position for a short period of time.
Yeah, and that he'd done a decent job, and that Anderson, who also ran on the platform of, well, I'm experienced as a county auditor, didn't seem to get traction with voters because nobody really thought that Hobbs was doing a bad job. So there you go. Mm-hmm. For the state legislature, there was one particularly close race for state representative District 37 position 2. Chipolo Street maintained about a 5,600 vote lead over community organizer Imijah Smith. And with only about 3,000 votes left to count in King County, those results in that race are now final. Chipolo Street will be going to the legislature. Now, there are also a few very, very close races in other districts around the state. And I just wanted to talk about 4 of those. In District 10, which is up in the northwest corner of Snohomish County, the southwest corner of Skagit County, and includes Whidbey and Kamano Islands, that's the one race that's still open in the state. Democrat Clyde Shavers is ahead of Republican Greg Gilday by just 221 votes. That's as of Friday night. There's about 7,000 votes left to count in Skagit County and another 500 in Snohomish County. So that race could flip depending on where in the county those voters are. So that's one to keep an eye on. But so far, it looks like that race is going to go to the Democrat in District 10. And then for state senator in District 26, that's the island areas of Kitsap and Pierce counties, Democrat Emily Randall beat Republican Jesse Young by just 1,299 votes, particularly close race, and showing that District 26 is starting to lean Democrat now, which is great news. In that district, another close race for state rep position one, Republican Spencer Hutchins beat Democrat Addison Richards by just 719 votes. And there's less than 100 votes to count in Kitsap and Pierce counties. So these are going to be final results for those two races. So the state senator seat went to a Democrat by a very narrow margin, and the two House positions went to Republicans, but one of them was very, very close. So, and the other race was also fairly close, but I think it was more like 2,000 to 3,000 votes separating them. So that district is starting to lean Democrat, and it's one of the areas of the state where the Democrats are making inroads. So that's kind of interesting. And then the final race I want to talk about for the state Senate is in District 42 in Whatcom County, right up on the Canadian border in a major upset in that district. Democrat Sharon Shoemake just squeaked past Republican incumbent Simon Sefcik by 804 votes. There are only about 150 votes left to count in Whatcom County. So that's a final result too.
Wow.
The other 42nd district races were close too, with the two Democrats, Alicia Rule and Joe Timmons, for the House seats, winning their races by about 2,500 and 1,800 votes each. So, not huge margins there, but a sign that that district, District 42, right up there in Whatcom County, right next to the Canadian border, is also turning to the Democrats.
So it really shows how freaking mm-hmm. important it is that people turn out to vote.
Oh, absolutely.
These races are so close.
Absolutely. When you have, you know, less than 1,000 votes determining a race, every vote counts. And in the case of the District 10 race, where, you know, 221 votes separate the front runner from the trailer, it's just, you know, kind of nail biting and very, very important that you turn out to, that if you're registered, you turn out to vote. And if you're not registered, go register and vote in the next election. Now we have a total of 49 districts in Washington state. So 49 total senators in the state Senate and 98 total representatives in the state House. So two per district. And overall, Democrats have gained one seat in the House to have a 59% majority, so just short of a 60% majority, and that's if Clyde Shavers wins in District 10. Okay, and that seat's still open. The Democrats will also continue to have a 59% majority in the Senate with 29 seats versus the Republicans' 20 seats, and I don't think that's a change from this last year. I think the Democrats won one seat and lost one seat to the Republicans. So it's going to be the same majority in the Senate. I find it kind of interesting that both houses are right at 59% majority, just short of a 60% majority.
Yeah.
But still good news there.
Mm-hmm.
And then one final issue in race in the local election. In the ballot measures, Seattle propositions number 1A and 1B. You know, the last time we talked about the results in this race, the no vote was ahead. But with just 3,000 votes outstanding in King County, the yes vote to change Seattle's primary election system has pulled ahead by over 6,000 votes. So that is the final result on question number one. The answer that voters gave was yes. So that means that the top two primary is now gone in Seattle.
Oh.
So on question number two, voters overwhelmingly chose Proposition 1B for ranked choice voting by 76% of the vote. So well over three quarters of voters opted for ranked choice voting. And what was interesting to me is that only about 10% of the people who voted on question one didn't go on to cast a vote on question two, which is kind of interesting and also great. It means that voters understood the necessity of voting on both questions, but it also gave us a very clear ranking of these three voting systems. So voters went for ranked choice voting as their number one option, the top two primary as a close second, and approval voting as a very, very distant third. So I found that to be quite interesting. It was the approval voting folks who wanted this vote to happen, but they lost big time, I think, on this issue. But it's turned out to be a great victory for ranked choice voting. So in our next election, we'll get to vote for more than one candidate and be able to rank them, which I'm really excited about.
Oh, yeah. I'm betting the editorial board at Seattle Times isn't probably as excited as you, but.
Yeah, no, I think their recommendation was that people vote no on question one and then not vote at all on question two. And I find it kind of interesting that only about 10% of voters did actually follow that advice. So, very terrible advice from the Seattle Times, but you know, there you have it.
Yeah. All right. Well, that's going to be exciting.
Mm-hmm. I think so. So that wraps up local election coverage for this year.
Okay.
Some good news and some very, very interesting races this year. The Democrats maintain control of the state legislature, along with our Democratic governor. I expect that they'll be able to make some strides this coming year on, particularly on environmental issues like climate change, but hopefully also on some other things in the state as well that need attention.
Yeah, let's both hope that they do, but make sure to push them in the correct direction towards the answers.
Yes. And of course, I'll cover some of those things as we get into the next legislative session towards the end of this year and beginning of next year.
So, city budget.
City budget, yes. On Monday of this past week, November 14th, the Seattle City Council Budget Chair, Teresa Mosqueda, released the balancing package incorporating the council's changes to the mayor's proposed biannual budget for 2023 and 2024. Now, the new proposed budget, the council's version, uses $85 million from the Jumpstart Payroll Tax Fund in 2023 to plug the hole in the general fund budget. In 2024, it will use $84 million from Jumpstart. That still leaves almost $220 million in 2023 and over $223 million in 2024 to spend on Jumpstart payroll tax priorities, including low-income housing, equitable development, economic revitalization, and Green New Deal programs. To do this swap, though, the council will have to pass a separate bill to allow the transfers for 2023 and 2024, but not beyond that. So they'll be rejecting Mayor Harrell's proposal to make permanent changes to how the Jumpstart payroll tax money can be spent. Teresa Mosqueda is counting on the Progressive Revenue Work Group to come up with new sources of financing for the city to balance its budgets from 2025 onward. So she drafted the legislation to just allow transfers from the Jumpstart Payroll Tax Fund in 2023 and 2024. In addition, money will be pulled out of the reserve accounts, about $21 million in 2023 and $12 million in 2024. There are also bills to make inflation adjustments to fees in the Department of Construction and Inspections and the Fire Department, and to increase fees for the renewal of restricted parking zone permits from $65 to $95, which would be the first increase that increase in cost for parking zone permits since 2010. There's also a bill to increase the city's portion of the vehicle license fee from $40 to $50 and use the proceeds for the funding priorities in the transportation department. Now, the capital budget will take some big cuts on infrastructure spending because of the slowdown in real estate development, which is leading to a downturn in the real estate excise tax, which typically funds infrastructure. Now, that will include about $46 million in infrastructure funding cuts over the two-year period, and it will delay things like renovating community centers, rehabbing play areas in our parks, adding ADA access to some parks facilities, making library building upgrades, and money for painting bridges and adding sidewalk safety improvements. Overall, expenditures are expected to go down by about 8.6% next year in the city's budget. Then they'll rise by about 4% in 2024. So this is a budget that has quite a few cuts in it. Now, there's a 10-page list of amendments to the mayor's proposed budget. When I started looking at those amendments, it looked to me like the council literally took his budget apart and then reassembled it. I don't think I've seen that many amendments for, I don't know, I think maybe as long as I've been looking at city budgets and city budget amendments. It just to me looked like maybe twice the number of amendments, maybe three times the number of amendments I typically see. So they literally did just disassemble his entire budget. And many of the amendments cut out new programs that the mayor wanted to fund. So a lot of his new stuff, they just said, nope, we're taking that out, taking that out, taking that out. And a number of the amendments restore funding for many of the programs that he cut in order to fund his priorities. So the council literally looked at his budget and said, nope, we're cutting out all your priorities and we're going to add back all of the things that we have prioritized in prior budgets that you decided to cut. Essentially. And there's no way I can cover all the amendments, but there's about a dozen of them that I think are really consequential, and interesting. And I'm just going to go over them. I'll try to be quick, but thorough on these 12 amendments.
Cool. Sounds good.
Yeah. So Teresa's Mosqueda's first off the bat, Teresa Mosqueda and Lisa Herbold proposed a couple of amendments that are very, very important. Mosqueda's amendment to add $7.1 million to fund a full cost of living wage increase for service providers, which would be in line with inflation for 2023, unlike Mayor Harrell's proposal of only a 4% increase, which would have meant a pay cut for these important frontline human service workers and would have forced the city council to pass a bill going back on their promise to these workers to provide them a cost of living increase every year. Now, Lisa Herbold also proposed an amendment that would add $5.6 million to fully fund a wage increase in 2024, the second year of the budget. So those two amendments are right up there at the top of the list of amendments to Harrell's budget, and they've been widely supported by the council. The only council member to oppose them is Sarah Nelson, who questioned them kind of from the perspective of a creepy, horribly capitalist business owner saying, oh gosh, if we give cost of living increases to these workers, won't we have to give them to everybody who works for the city? Which led the other city council members to go, if we don't give them to these workers, you know, we're literally being probably the worst employer in the state. So, you know, cause you're really talking about people who do some of the most necessary work in the city, in city government, you know, working with the elderly, with the homeless, with the disabled. And very often these folks are women or they're people of color. So when you say, oh, you know, we're gonna dump a pay cut on you, that's really pretty horrible. So that was pretty much the response from all the other city council members, including Council President Deborah Juarez. So I think those amendments are gonna pass. Secondly, Teresa Mosqueda's amendment to reduce Mayor Harrell's expansion of the HOPE team by eight full-time staff. She's cut it down by removing five of those full-time staff and would send the $812,000 in savings plus an additional $400,000 to the King County Regional Homelessness Authority for their outreach program instead. Harrell would have expanded the team by eight staff, but Mosqueda's amendment would cut that down to three new staff and cut the funding for those five and send it to the King County Regional Homelessness Authority. She rightly thought that that really should be a function, that outreach program really should be a function of the Regional Homelessness Authority rather than the city, taking that on. Nevertheless, she allowed an additional three new staff for Harrell in order to have one person in each of the areas of the city that that the Human Services Department has divided the city up into eight different areas. There would be at least one outreach person from the city in each of those areas. So, but I think she also wants a report back to see exactly what the HOPE team is doing there. And I think the council is wondering, you know, why expand this when we're not exactly sure what this program is doing for the city. So, that will probably pass as well. And then third, there's a total of $10.4 million in an amendment that will be added to the Parks District Fund to cover the new six-year spending plan for the Seattle Parks. The city council, the full city council, which is the Parks District board, essentially, they voted to approve the Parks District Fund six-year spending plan. And so this is the money that they're going to put behind that. A fourth amendment is Lisa Herbold originally proposed adding $7.8 million for the lead and co-lead diversion programs so that they could expand to accept everyone who is transferred into the programs. The balancing package cuts that down to $4 million for 2023 only, with the understanding that the Public Defenders Association, which manages the lead and co-lead programs, would find another source of funding for 2024 and onward. That could, and I don't know that I agree with this. It looks to me like the council is saying, though, that they want lead and co-lead to start providing them more information on what the programs are doing. Start filling out paperwork, start applying for grants so that we can see what the outcome is for some of the work here. I know that this year the King County Council also passed in as part of their budget process an amendment to their budget saying that lead and co-lead will have to start competing with other groups for funding from the county council. They have to start applying for funding instead of just assuming that the King County Council is going to give them money every year. So I think it's a push by these two government groups, the King County Council and the Seattle City Council, to say, hey, you know, we've been funding you for a while now. The programs are set up and running, but we want you to start giving us some more information on how the programs operate, what the money we're giving you is going to fund, and what the outcomes are, which if you think about it, it's good fiscal management. Now, the flip side of that coin is when you start requiring programs to do this administrative work, it pulls resources away from their program work. So that's the flip side of that coin. Sometimes just giving them the money and saying, hey, we think you're doing a good job. You don't have to jump through the hoops to provide us all this and for us to do all this oversight. Sometimes that can be beneficial and programs can be more efficient in the money that they spend and they don't have to struggle from year to year for survival. But, But there's also the question of, okay, is that money being used wisely? Or could it go for other things? And I think in a year where the city council is looking around to fund, they have to cut some things. They have to make some really hard decisions on what to fund and not to fund. You'll often see these kinds of things where the council is saying, okay, here are these things we continue to fund, but are they really a wise use of our dollars? So that's in there. We'll see if Lisa Herbold proposes an amendment to amend this or to add to this and has some funding source for it. I don't know. We'll find out. Mm-hmm. And then fifth on the list, an amendment to delete the mayor's proposal to move the Parking Enforcement Division out of the Seattle Department of Transportation and back into the Seattle Police Department. And an additional amendment that requires the city budget office to provide the council with recommendations on where the parking enforcement division should be housed to kind of analyze it and report back to the city council. So that proposal by Mayor Bruce Harrell will also be undone with this amendment. Sixth on my list is an amendment that would cut the Seattle Police Department budget for salary savings from 80 positions that they haven't been able to fill, and then redirects that money back into the general fund. That still leaves plenty of money for the Seattle Police Department's hiring goals for the next 2 years. And there's a series of amendments as well requesting that the Seattle Police Department make reports to the council on staffing, overtime, the department's finances, performance metrics like how many 911 calls are being answered and in what time frame, the risk management demand project, which is an analysis of 911 calls and how they get how they get handled, and report on emphasis patrols, and also a report on backgrounding services. So lots and lots of oversight of the Seattle Police Department. So you can expect there to be a lot of reports coming up in the following year on what's going on at the SPD. There, and then seventh on my list is a series of amendments that cuts new Seattle Police Department funding for retention, recruitment, new equipment, and of course, the gunfire detection system. So there's an amendment in there that would completely cut out the funding for that new gunfire detection system. And then number eight on my list is an amendment from Lisa Herbold to request that the Seattle Fire Department also report to the council on their staffing, overtime, finances, and performance metrics. So now the Seattle Fire Department is also coming under oversight. And I think, you can say, oh, no, you know, why force the fire department to undergo this same process? But, you know, it really is both educational for the public to find out what exactly, you know, our taxpayer money is funding in the fire department and what the fire department does and what are all of the different programs that fall under the fire department. But also it's really, I think, it's educational for the city council members. And I think it's also interesting too, because sometimes when you open up the black box of a department's budget, people from the outside can make great suggestions, and it can get the department heads to start thinking about more efficient changes within their department. So ways to do the same job that are more efficient and that save money or that help them to get the same kind of work done with fewer people, especially in these years when it's hard to hire new people and to get new folks in. So
help them think outside of the black box.
Yeah, exactly. So I think that's a really good thing. And, you know, I would like to see this happen maybe for other agencies as well. But it's interesting to me that it's the fire department that's joining it now. So I think that's a good move, and I hope that that amendment passes. Mm-hmm. And then also on the list too, Lisa Herbold's amendment to add $717,000, which is down from $2.6 million in her original amendment, to the Community Safety and Communications Center to fund a new program for the 911 call center to dispatch a team of trained mental behavioral health workers alongside police officers for some types of 911 calls. So she had originally proposed $2.6 million for that, but, got to cut costs in a few areas, and Mosqueda found room for $717,000 to fund that as a starter program.
Okay.
And then Tammy Morales had originally proposed an amendment to restore about $9.4 million of COVID-19 relief funds that the King County Regional Homelessness Authority is losing at the end of this year. Mosqueda consulted with the King County Regional Homelessness Authority, and they said that they could find about $5 to $6 million that they haven't spent yet in this year, that they'll be able to carry over next year to cover some of those programs. So the balancing package includes the difference, which is $3.9 million. This money will mostly go to fund rapid rehousing programs. So that's also there in the budget. And then Andrew Lewis has an amendment to add $2.8 million for repairs to 9 of the city's existing tiny home villages and expansion of case managers and behavioral health support at all 11 tiny home villages in the city. That amendment has survived into the balancing package fully funded. So we'll see if that one passes.
Oh, good.
Yeah. And then the last one on my list of amendments that I thought was very interesting was two amendments to add about $2 million for rental assistance and eviction legal defense. The eviction legal defense amendment was proposed by Shama Sawant. So, and I think that also the rental assistance may have been proposed by her too, but that amendment was revised for the funds to come from a different source. So it's listed as being proposed by the Council Budget Committee. So those two amendments, very, very important to assist renters in a time when folks are suffering from a high rate of evictions.
Oh, yeah.
I think very, very important. So the council is going to start voting on the amendments to the balance package next Monday, November 21st. And that's expected to take at least a couple of days. It may take longer. We'll see, because there's a lot of amendments. Mm-hmm. Council members can propose new amendments, or they can add in amendments that didn't make it into the balancing package, but only if they also specify a funding source for those amendments. So new amendments have to balance to be added to the balancing package. Now, the council's goal is to take their final vote on the budget on Tuesday, November 29th. That's the Tuesday after the Thanksgiving holiday. And with all of the changes in this budget, we'll just have to see if they make that deadline. It may be a scramble.
Did they, you had spoken about it on a prior show, but did they address in the balancing package Mayor Harrell's proposal to increase salaries for his own staff?
I don't think they made any changes to that. Increasing salaries for his staff were based on, based on inflation. And a lot of the time they're based on the employment contracts or the union contracts that different employees fall under. So a lot of that's just considered kind of basic cost increases in the budget.
Okay.
He had, I think what you're thinking of is he had some programs he was trying to add to the budget that I talked about in a prior show, and a lot of those are being cut. It looks like they're being cut out of the budget. One of the programs that isn't being cut is the program that I talked about where the mayor's office got a grant from the Casey Family Foundation that's listed in the council bill to accept grants for different city departments. So that's still listed there. It looks to me like the additional money in order to that was allocated to the mayor's office in order to match the funds and receive that grant. It looks like that's still in the budget as well. So it looks like Mayor Harrell will get his wish to add some new interns to help him with public safety programming. So that is still in there, but many, many of his other priorities that he added into the budget. I think I talked about things like money to bring on. I can't remember off the top of my head, but there were a number of different items in there that looked like they were mostly, you know, boosting tourism and doing kind of marketing related things. A lot of that stuff's been cut out by the city council's amendments.
Like the annual graffiti removal day.
Yeah, a lot of the money for graffiti removal has been cut as well. So he had a lot of money in there for the unified care team. Quite a bit of that money is still in there, but portions of it have been cut back or the amounts have been reduced. So we'll see.
Okay. Hillary France in the news this week.
Yeah, our state Commissioner of Public Lands, Hillary Franz, made a very important announcement this week. She announced an executive order to ban all net pen fish farming in the state's waterways. That was after she terminated the leases with Cook Aquaculture, the remaining leases, this week. I want to remind folks that back in 2017, net pen up near Cypress Island, that was managed by Cook Aquaculture, burst open and released about 260,000 non-native Atlantic salmon into Washington state waters. And that has been considered an environmental disaster by local fishermen and tribes. And that led to the state legislature considering bills to end net pen fishing in Washington state. And the legislature passed a bill to ease them out. So they didn't immediately terminate Cook Aquaculture's leases. It did put a time limit on them. And, this week, Washington State Commissioner Hillary Franz, Commissioner of Public Lands Hillary Franz, announced that the state is done. So we now join, Oregon, California, and Alaska in banning net pen aquaculture in our state's waterways. So that's some very, very good news this week.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. All right. Moving on to national then.
We'll talk a little bit about the national election. In the Senate, the Democrats won in Nevada, where Catherine Cortez Masto pulled ahead of pro-Trump Republican Adam Laxalt. The Democrats now have 50 seats in the Senate and a chance to win a 51st seat in December when Raphael Warnock goes up against the dismal pro-Trump Herschel Walker in Georgia.
Yeah.
Now,
and if anybody, you know, wants to check out just any of Herschel Walker's random speeches this week.
Oh, yeah. Yeah.
They're all gems.
Yes. And in the House, the Republicans have reached the critical majority of 218 seats. There are four races that still haven't been called, but three of those are leaning Republican and only one is leaning Democrat. So the Republicans will have a slim majority. But remember, their party is deeply divided. And a lot of the new members are not just pro-Trump election deniers. They also have zero experience in government. And for many of them, their connection to reality is questionable. So this is going to be a huge challenge for the House in the coming 2 years. The crazy wing of the Republican Party in the House has already been quick to enumerate their key issues. So on a list of their key issues, it includes things like an investigation of Hunter Biden, setting up a select committee to investigate China, an investigation of the January 6th investigation, an investigation of Anthony Fauci, many different investigations of the FBI, the Department of Justice, and the U.S. Chamber of Commerce, and of course, cutting off military aid to the Ukraine. So they're already stirring up the pot. and trying to exert some influence on the Republican leadership, Kevin McCarthy met with a number of the members of the crazy wing of his party, including Marjorie Taylor Greene. And he's going to have his hands full trying to whip everybody into consensus on any bills in the coming legislative sessions. So we'll see. Now, as for the Democratic leadership, Nancy Pelosi and her two other leading Democrats in the House stepped down. Majority Leader Steny Hoyer of Maryland and Majority Whip James Clyburn of South Carolina. They're all in their 80s, and they had all promised that after this election they would be stepping down for a new leadership team. Three new younger leaders are emerging as leading candidates to take their place. Representative Hakeem Jeffries of New York, Catherine Clark of Massachusetts, and Pete Aguilar of California. And if confirmed as minority leader, Jeffries would be the first Black party leader in the U.S. House of Representatives. So that would be a historic first. Hakeem Jeffries, I just wanted to kind of talk a little bit about these three folks so that you know who they are. Okay. Hakeem Jeffries has served as the whip for the Congressional Black Caucus. He represents a district that in New York that includes portions of Brooklyn and Queens and has a lot of public housing residents and folks who've prioritized things like police reform and stop and frisk laws. He's been vocal about racist stop and frisk policing. He's a supporter of voting rights, and he's worked hard to try to address the lack of federal funding for public housing improvements. Since 2019, he served as the chair of the House Democratic Caucus, which put him fifth in line in the Democratic House leadership. He was also selected to be one of the seven House members to present the impeachment case against Donald Trump to the U.S. Senate. He's also a member of the Congressional Progressive Caucus and has served on the House Judiciary Committee and the Budget Committee. So some key committees in the House there, particularly the Budget Committee. He understands how budget issues work and how important putting your money where your mouth is. And as a member of the Congressional Progressive Caucus, he's looking really good to the progressive wing of the party there. So it would be terrific, I think, to have him step up and fill Pelosi's spot. And it may give the progressive wing of the party a bit more influence. Now, for the number two position, Catherine Clark, she's making her bid for the party whip position, which will put her in the number two spot. She served as the assistant House Democratic leader since 2021, so number four in the Democratic House leadership. And before that, she was vice chair of the House Democratic Caucus. She currently sits on the House Appropriations Committee, which is a particularly key committee in the House. It considers every bill that involves a budget or an expense. And she also sits on many, many different caucuses, including the Congressional Women's Caucus, the Medicare for All Caucus, and the Congressional Progressive Caucus. So again, a member of the Progressive Caucus in the House stepping up for the number two position in the Democratic leadership. So that could be a very, very positive move as well. And then for the number three spot, Pete Aguilar is currently the vice chair of the House Democratic Caucus and the highest ranking Latinx lawmaker in Congress. He's particularly strong on civil rights, immigration rights, LGBTQ issues, and environmental issues. He is one of eight House members appointed to sit on the committee to investigate the January 6th attack on the U.S. Capitol. He also sits on the Appropriations Committee. So again, that very important committee that considers every bill that has any kind of expense or budget attached to it. And he also sits on the Committee on House Administration. He, like Catherine Clark, he also belongs to many caucuses in the House, including the Congressional Hispanic Caucus, the Climate Solutions Caucus, and the New Democrat Coalition, which is not the Progressive Caucus. It's a centrist group of pro-business Democrats. So he's much more of a centrist and socially liberal, perhaps more fiscally conservative, and definitely pro-business. So he's stepping up for the number three position in the House. So that's who we have running for the top three positions, and we'll see if any other members, any other representatives step up to challenge them. But typically the Democrats, I think, have aligned behind these three. At least two of them, well, actually all three of them have held positions within the Democratic leadership. So I think it would be unusual for someone who has not held those positions to step up and challenge them, but you never know. So, yeah, I think it's really positive to see two members of the Progressive Caucus and one centrist. That's, I think, a change for the Democrats. It will be interesting to see how that shapes their policies in the coming year or two years. And also with the next election cycle, we could see, if the Democrats take control of the House again, we could see these folks step up and be House Speaker and Majority Leader. And Majority Whip, that would be, I think, very, very interesting. So I'm kind of excited about that. Now, also, Pramila Jayapal will run again for chair of the Congressional Progressive Caucus, which she has headed. And it's going to be interesting because that caucus is gaining about a dozen new members this year with the new incoming Democrats, many of whom are young and are more progressive candidates than we've seen in the past in the Democratic Party. It's going to make the Progressive Caucus one of the largest caucuses in Congress. So that will also be interesting.
Wow.
Yeah. So some good news there with the elections. Even though the Democrats lost control of the House, they've maintained control of the Senate, and we're seeing the Progressive Caucus grow in numbers, as well as two members of the Progressive Caucus step up as number one and number two of the Democratic Party leadership. So that's kind of historic and very hopeful, I think.
Yeah, they're upgrading their party.
Yeah, and we can hope that they'll make some upgrades, too, in the national campaign party apparatus so that more progressive candidates can get the funding that they need to win their races and not have to scramble and work super hard for funding. And, you know, I mean, if this last election has proved anything, it's that progressive candidates can win in Republican-held districts. Formerly Republican-held districts, like Marie Glusenkamp-Perez did here in Washington State's 3rd District.
Well, moving on, did you want to talk about the COP27, or did you want to...
Let's visit the Twitter apocalypse.
Okay.
I have to say my favorite Twitter apocalypse headline this week was in the Jeff Bezos rag, the Washington Post. The headline was, Musk summons engineers to Twitter HQ as millions await platform's collapse. I saw that. I just burst out laughing. I'm like, yeah. Uh-huh. But that's kind of what it is. I mean, a lot of users on Twitter, particularly people who have been using it for many, many years and are heavy users of Twitter, are making plans to go elsewhere, and they're making contingency plans in case the platform itself goes offline and doesn't come back. On Wednesday of this week, Elon Musk gave the remaining Twitter employees an ultimatum: either sign a pledge and get on board with his plan to force Twitter employees back to the office to work overtime and weekends, or put in their resignation by 5 p.m. Thursday, November 17th, and then they would be able to collect 3 months severance pay, but they'd be out the door, right?
Mm-hmm.
Well, Thursday came and went, and hundreds of employees put in their resignation, somewhere close to 1,000 employees, according to some estimates, in spite of a last-ditch meeting that he called with his quote-unquote critical employees to try and persuade them to stay. He also called last-minute meetings on Friday and Saturday with, quote, employees who actually write code, end quote, in order to get an understanding of the Twitter tech stack, as he called it. I think a really clear sign that he's in over his head and is finally starting to think that, maybe I've lost too many employees, right? When Elon Musk purchased Twitter, it had around 7,500 employees. Okay. He immediately fired about half of those folks. And then on Thursday, another 1,000 or so resigned. And it's thought that now, many of the folks who stayed are there because they need the health insurance or because they're in the United States on a work visa that's tied to their job and that they'd be deported if they lost their job. That's not an ideal, office environment, let me tell you. Yeah.
Putting it mildly.
Yeah. Now, many key teams that keep the website running were cut completely or depleted down to just one person after Thursday's massacre. And even if the site isn't hit by hackers or malicious code or dealing with hardware failures, I think it's just a matter of time before something gives way. And the person or people who would understand how it works and be able to fix it won't be there to do that job. Okay. In the meantime, Musk violated one of the agreements he made when he purchased Twitter. He initially said he would appoint an outside content moderation panel to review requests to restore accounts that were suspended, but he hasn't done that. Instead, he started to unilaterally restore accounts on his own, including the accounts of a conservative website, Babylon Bee, and the right-wing commentator, Jordan Peterson. Both of those accounts were suspended for posting anti-transgender content. And Musk is just kind of willy-nilly waving his magic wand and deciding who gets restored and who doesn't. He hasn't yet restored Donald Trump, but he may.
He had a poll for it. So that it's not his decision, or, I mean, we know he's going to decide it in the end, but he basically, you know, created a poll. So you decide, do you want him back or not?
Right. Yeah, that's great. Now, Yoel Roth, the former head of trust and safety at Twitter, wrote an op-ed in the New York Times this week saying that he had resigned from Twitter because it was clear that Elon Musk would be making his own decisions about which accounts would be banned or reinstated, which was absolutely unworkable. He also warned that Twitter's phone app could be banned from the Apple Store or the Google Play Store if the Twitter platform devolved into hate speech, pornography, or some other objectionable content. Civil rights groups have already pointed out that that there's been a huge uptick in hate speech on Twitter since Musk purchased the company. Many of Twitter's advertisers have put a freeze on running ads on the site, and many users, as I've said, are transitioning to other social media sites. And I think a big twist test for Twitter will be coming up with the upcoming World Cup game. Social media use tends to surge during major sporting events. Another key test is going to be the first time the company has to implement one of Elon Musk's many changes that he's promised to do on the Twitter platform. And that's when a website or a software system is most vulnerable and most likely to break or have issues is when you start making changes to it. And then I should point out something I told Mike just before we went on air is that this has all been terrible publicity for Elon Musk's other companies. And I told Mike, I said, if I was ever thinking of purchasing a Tesla, now I think I would be looking elsewhere for my electric vehicle. And I don't think Elon Musk really realizes how this is going to affect his other companies as well as perhaps destroy Twitter. Something that he should be considering, but that he's not, that terrible publicity is terrible publicity for all your companies, not just for the one that you're taking apart and destroying. So that wraps up coverage of Twitter.
All right. A couple minutes to talk about the climate summit that happened.
Yeah, COP27, climate summit in Egypt. And over the last couple of weeks was the International COP27. COP stands for Conference of Parties, the nations that agreed to lower their global warming emissions. 27 means it's the 27th annual summit. And while Donald Trump refused to participate when he was a president, Joe Biden traveled to the summit this year and addressed the conference. But some other key world leaders stayed home. There were no delegates from China, Russia, or India, for example, all major climate pollution, major climate emission emitters. Biden talked up the Inflation Protection Act that the Democrats passed this last year with its $369 billion in spending on clean energy and infrastructure. But every year, scientists release reports timed to give the conference participants an idea of how the world is doing in reducing greenhouse gases. This year's reports have showed some pretty alarming things, I think. Nations are on course to burn through their remaining carbon budgets within less than a decade if they don't make steeper cuts. And because of the war in Ukraine, a number of nations have been cut off from Russian natural gas. That has led them to search for new sources and drill new wells, which are projected to eat up about 10% of that remaining carbon budget. New oil wells and new natural gas wells are not great ways to cut your climate emissions. The voluntary carbon trading market is still very small, with only about $1 billion in carbon offsets traded last year, not nearly enough to make a global impact on greenhouse gas emissions. So the voluntary carbon trading market is not taking off as planned. Developing nations this year have been demanding that the industrialized countries that have spewed the most greenhouse gases, including the United States, provide some financial help to developing countries so that they can afford to make the shift to clean energy and have funds to recover from climate disasters which are affecting their countries. They formed a coalition called the Climate Vulnerable Forum. So far, the response has been, quote, "We'll make it a little easier for you to borrow money from the IMF and the World Bank," end quote. And I should point out that those are institutions that have already hooked too many developing nations into deep, deep debt cycles. So just providing more loans, particularly in today's higher interest environment, is not an answer to that demand.
It's an answer for disaster.
It is. Yeah. Earlier this year, well, disaster, especially for nations who then could see natural gas exploration or oil exploration as a way to pay off their debts in particular. So you don't want to get them hooked deeper into debt cycles when they're already saying, hey, you're asking us not, a country like Nigeria, for example, you're asking us not to drill new wells. We need that money, you know?
Right.
So earlier this year, Joe Biden asked Congress to pass $11 billion in foreign aid for climate assistance to developing countries. But of course, Congress has not taken it up. And the new Republican-controlled House is certainly not going to act on that. But the main new initiative that the U.S. delegation, including Biden's climate envoy, John Kerry, is promoting this year is a proposal from a group of philanthropies and corporations to help finance clean energy projects in developing countries, a type of carbon trading scheme. But that initiative would be completely voluntary, again, like the voluntary carbon trading plan, with no requirements for private companies to participate. The groups behind this plan include the Rockefeller Foundation, the Bezos Earth Fund, PepsiCo, and Microsoft. It seems pretty clear to me that you know, this is all an effort by corporations to head off a system of required cap and trade or carbon tax regimes in various countries, which would be much more expensive for corporations to deal with than this voluntary scheme. There's also been discussions about how carbon offset schemes can harm developing nations. So, for example, a corporation may pay to build a hydropower project in a developing nation, but that project might draw water from and disrupt local agriculture and cause food shortages in that country. In the meantime, the company that paid for the project is still able to continue spewing its greenhouse gases, right? So developing nations are calling instead for more governments to impose carbon taxes, and that's exactly what these major corporations are trying to avoid. So that's been the situation at COP27 this year.